Chapter 14. André de Surier held his steel helmet against his chest, the way a man holds his hat at a funeral. The wind blew cool and caressing through his dark, sweat-damp hair. His hearing was dulled by the strike of the shell that had cut the truck loose from the rear of the train. He could hear one of the children crying, and the crooning, gentling voice of its mother. He stared back up the railway line at the train, saw the great bulk of Ruffy beside Bruce Curry on the roof of the second coach. "They can't help us now," Boussier spoke softly. "There's nothing they can do." He lifted his hand stiffly in almost a military salute, and then dropped it to his side. "Be brave, ma chère," he said to his wife. "Please be brave." And she clung to him. André let the helmet drop from his hands. It clanged onto the metal floor of the truck. He wiped the sweat from his face with nervous, fluttering hands, and then turned slowly to look down at the village. "I don't want to die," he whispered. "Not like this. Not now. Please not now." One of his gendarmes laughed, a sound without mirth, and stepped across to the Brenne. He pushed André away from it and started firing at the tiny running figures of the men in the station yard. "No," shrilled André. "Don't do that, no, don't antagonize them. They'll kill us if you do that."
"They'll kill us anyway," laughed the gendarme, and emptied the magazine in one long, despairing burst. André started towards him, perhaps to pull him away from the gun, but his resolve did not carry him that far. His hands dropped to his sides, clenching and unclenching. His lips quivered and then opened to spill out his terror.
"No," he screamed. "Please, no, no! Oh, God, have mercy! Oh, save me, don't let this happen to me! Please, God, oh, my God!"
He stumbled to the side of the truck and clambered onto it. The truck was slowing as it ran into the platform. He could see men coming with rifles in their hands, shouting as they ran. Black men in dirty, tattered uniforms, their faces working with excitement, pink, shouting mouths baying like hounds in a pack. André jumped, and the dusty concrete of the platform grazed his cheek and knocked the wind out of him. He crawled to his knees, clutching his stomach and trying to scream. A rifle butt hit him between the shoulder blades, and he collapsed. Above him a voice shouted in French, "He is white, keep him for the general, don't kill him." And again the rifle butt hit him, this time across the side of the head. He lay in the dust, dazed, with the taste of blood in his mouth, and watched them drag the others from the truck. They shot the black gendarmes on the platform, without ceremony, laughing as they competed with each other to use their bayonets on the corpses. The two children died quickly, torn from their mothers, held by the feet, and swung head first against the steel side of the truck. Old Boussier tried to prevent them stripping his wife, and was bayoneted from behind in anger, and then shot twice with a pistol held to his head as he lay on the platform. All this happened in the first few minutes before the officers arrived to control them. By that time, André and the four women were the only occupants of the truck left alive. André lay where he had fallen, watching in fascinated, skin-crawling horror as they tore the clothing off the women, and with a man to each arm and each leg, held them down on the platform as though they were calves to be branded, hooting with laughter at their struggling naked bodies, bickering for position, already unbuckling belts, pushing each other, arguing, some of them with fresh blood on their clothing. But then two men, who by their air of authority and the red sashes across their chests were clearly officers, joined the crowd. One of them fired his pistol in the air to gain their attention, and both of them started a harangue that slowly had effect. The women were dragged up and herded off towards the hotel. One of the officers came across to where André lay, stooped over him, and lifted his head by taking a handful of hair.
"Welcome, mon ami. The general will be very pleased to see you. It is a pity that your other white friends have left us, but then one is better than nothing."
He pulled André into a sitting position, peered into his face, and then spat into his eyes with sudden violence. "Bring him. The general will talk to him later." They tied André to one of the columns on the front veranda of the hotel and left him there. He could have twisted his head and looked through the large windows into the lounge at what they were doing to the women, but he did not. He could hear what was happening. By noon, the screams had become groans and sobbing. By mid-afternoon, the women were making no sound at all, but the queue of Schufter was still out of the front door of the lounge. Some of them had been to the head of the line and back to the tail 3 or 4 times now. All of them were drunk. One jovial fellow carried a bottle of Parfait Amour liqueur in one hand and a bottle of Harper's whiskey in the other. Every time he came back to join the queue again, he stopped in front of André. "Will you drink with me, little white boy?" he asked. "Certainly you will," he answered himself, filled his mouth from one of the bottles and spat it into André's face. Each time it got a big laugh from the others waiting in the line. Occasionally one of the other Schufter would stop in front of André, unsling his rifle back away a few paces, sight along the bayonet at André's face, and then charge forward, at the last moment twisting the point aside so that it grazed his cheek. Each time André could not suppress his shriek of terror, and the waiting men nearly collapsed with merriment. Towards evening, they started to burn the houses on the outskirts of town. One group, sad with liquor and rape, sat together at the end of the veranda and started to sing, their deep, beautiful voices carrying all the melancholy savagery of Africa. They kept on singing, while an argument between two Schufter developed into a knife fight in the road outside the hotel. The sweet bass lilt of singing covered the coarse breathing of the two circling, bare-chested knife fighters and the shuffle, shuffle, quick shuffle of their feet in the dust. When finally they locked together for the kill, the singing rose still deep and strong, but with a triumphant note to it. One man stepped back with his rigid right arm holding the knife buried deep in the other's belly, and as the loser sank down, sliding slowly off the knife, the singing sank with him, plaintive, regretful, and lamenting into silence. They came for André after dark, four of them less drunk than the others. They led him down the street to the Union Minière offices. General Moses was there, sitting alone at the desk in the front office. There was nothing sinister about him. He looked like an elderly clerk, a small man with a short woolen cap of hair grizzled to grey above the ears and a pair of horn-rimmed spectacles. On his chest he wore 3 rows of full-dress medals. Each of his fingers was encased in rings to the second joint, diamonds, emeralds, and the occasional red glow of a ruby. Most of them had been designed for women, but the metal had been cut to enlarge them for his stubby black fingers. The face was almost kindly, except the eyes. There was a blankness of expression in them, the lifeless eyes of a madman. On the desk in front of him was a small wooden case made of unvarnished deal, which bore the seal of the Union Minière Company, stenciled in black upon its side. The lid was open, and as André came in through the door with his escort, General Moses lifted a white canvas bag from the case, loosened the drawstring, and poured a pile of dark grey industrial diamonds onto the blotter in front of him. He prodded them thoughtfully with his finger, stirring them so they glittered dully in the harsh light of the Petromax. "Was this the only case in the truck?" he asked, without looking up. "Oui, mon général, there was only the one," answered one of André's escorts. "You are certain?" "Oui, mon général. I myself have searched thoroughly." General Moses took another of the canvas bags from the case and emptied it onto the blotter. He grunted with disappointment as he saw the drab little stones. He reached for another bag, and another, his anger mounting steadily as each yielded only dirty grey and black industrial diamonds. Soon the pile on the plotter would have filled a pint mug. "Did you open the case?" he snarled. "Non, mon général. It was sealed." "The seal was not broken. You saw that." General Moses grunted again, his dark chocolate face set hard with frustration. Once more he dipped his hand into the wooden case, and suddenly he smiled. "Ah," he said pleasantly. "Yes, yes, what is this?" He brought out a cigar box with the gaudy wrappers still on the cedar wood. A thumbnail prized the lid back, and he beamed happily. In a nest of cotton wool, sparkling, breaking the white light of the Petromax into all the rainbow colours of the spectrum, were the gemstones. General Moses picked one up and held it between thumb and forefinger. "Pretty," he murmured. "Pretty, so pretty." He swept the industrial stones to one side and laid the gem in the centre of the blotter. Then, one by one, he took the others from the cigar box, fondling each and laying it on the blotter, counting them, smiling, once chuckling softly, touching them, arranging them in patterns. "Pretty," he kept whispering. "Bon. 41, 42, pretty, my darlings. 43. Then suddenly he scooped them up and poured them into one of the canvas bags, tightened the drawstring, dropped it into his breast pocket above the medals, and buttoned the flap. He laid his black, bejewelled hands on the desk in front of him and looked up at André. His eyes were smoky yellow with black centres behind his spectacles. They had an opaque, dreamlike quality. "Take off his clothes," he said in a voice that was as expressionless as the eyes. They stripped André with rough dispatch, and General Moses looked at his body. "So white," he murmured. "Why so white?" Suddenly his jaws began chewing nervously, and there was a faint shine of sweat on his forehead. He came round from behind the desk, a small man, yet with an intensity about him that doubled his size. "White, like the maggots that feed in the living body of the elephant." He brought his face close to André's. "You should be fatter, my maggot, having fed so long and so well. You should be much fatter." He touched André's body, running his hands down his flanks in a caress. "But now it is too late, little white maggot," he said, and André cringed from his touch and from his voice. "For the elephant has shaken you from the wound, shaken you out onto the ground, shaken you out beneath his feet. And will you pop when he crushes you?" His voice was still soft through the sweat oozed in oily lines down his cheeks, and the dreaminess of his eyes had been replaced by a burning black brightness. "We shall see," he said, and drew back. "We shall see, my maggot," he repeated, and brought his knee up into André's crutch with a force that jerked his whole frame and flung his shoulders back. The agony flared through André's lower body, fierce as the touch of heated steel. It clamped in on his stomach, contracting it into a spasm like childbirth. It rippled up across the muscles of his chest into his head and burst beneath the roof of his skull in a whiteness that blinded him. "Hold him," commanded General Moses, his voice suddenly shrill. The two guards took André by the elbows and forced him to his knees so that his genitals and lower belly were easily accessible to the general's boots. They had done this often. "For the times you jailed me," and General Moses swung his booted foot into André's body. The pain blended with the other pain, and it was too strong for André to scream. "This for the insults," and André could feel his testicles crush beneath it. Still, it was too strong. He could not use his voice. "This for the times I have grovelled." The pain had passed its zenith. This time he could scream with it. He opened his mouth and filled his empty lungs. "This for the times I have hungered." Now he must scream. Now he must. The pain. "Oh, sweet Christ, I must. Please let me scream." "This for your white man's justice." "Why can't I? Please let me. Oh, no, no, please. Oh, God, oh, please." "This for your prisons and your kiboko." The kicks so fast now, like the beat of an insane drummer, like rain on a tin roof. In his stomach he felt something tear. "And this, and this, and this." The face before him filled the whole field of his vision. The voice and the sound of boot into him filled his ears. "This, and this, and this." The voice high-pitched, and within him the sudden warm flood of internal bleeding. The pain was fading now, as his body closed it out in defence. And he had not screamed. The leap of elation as he knew it, This last thing I can do well. I can die now without screaming. He tried to stand up, but they held him down, and his legs were not his own. They were on the other side of the great numb warmth of his belly. He lifted his head and looked at the man who was killing him. This for the white filth that bore you, and this, and this. The blows were not a part of reality. He could feel the shock of them as though he stood close to a man who was cutting down a tree with an axe, and André smiled. He was still smiling when they let him fall forward to the floor.
"I think he is dead," said one of the guards.
General Moses turned away and walked back to his seat at the desk. He was shaking as though he had run a long way, and his breathing was deep and fast. The jacket of his uniform was soaked with sweat. He sank into the chair, and his body seemed to crumple. Slowly the brightness faded from his eyes, until once more they were filmed over, opaque and dreamy. The two guards squatted down quietly on each side of André's body. They knew it would be a long wait. Through the open window there came an occasional shout of drunken laughter, and the red flicker and leap of flames.